Action.
Okay.
Quick question. What, there was a book that came out a few years ago that was like sort of Rabbi Nachman-like, that had a kind of greenish cover, and it was something, something, something on Aden. I personally found it incredibly annoying, but like a lot of people loved it.
Yes, I know the one.
The Garden of Amunah. Yes.
Yeah. Really, that was really annoying. So do you have it?
I think I might be able to find the point.
It's very flowery.
I know what you're... I think the rise is...
Okay. So we were at the intro. We were at the end of the show last time. Was we had set up that the we set up the claim of Dr. Steinberg that there were two right there are two principles of halacha, or two principles of autonomy that halacha conflicted with. We established that the principle of autonomy per se, and is not really the issue. The issue is coercion, and when it turned down that really the evidence for coercion was just the moroksia, and then when we went to the moroksia, we discovered that actually it has a very limited, sphere for coercion. It turns out that coercion really only applies to cases where there is where you're definitely going to die. Right. We believe the consequences of your action is definite death, and you agree with that. Right? But the Rebbe doesn't seem to allow you to take even wild risks for this, right? As long as we could not classify what you were doing as going out to commit suicide, ibud atzma l'dat. Right? So Jonathan pointed out afterwards, which is that the contemporary psak is actually, on the whole, more restrictive. We use a principle called Shomer Ptaim Hashem, which, right, as a control of what kind of risks you're allowed to enter into, which seems to set some kind of reasonable social standard model or something like that. Not entirely clear. I contend that Rav Yaakov Emden, if he uses that standard, he uses it a lot more expansively than we do nowadays. Right? It sounds to me like he thinks that, right, that the right, even because he says sometimes people survive the operation, so you can't stop them. Right? He doesn't. Right, it's not normal risk. That's what he says. Right? Yesh tamim shei vashay. Right? Lo tamim nevashay. Now, what we're not doing risk per se. So what I'm interested in is what seems to me to emerge from Yaakov Emden was that broad principle that really anytime anything other than suicide is left to the discretion of the patient. And the question is, why shouldn't we just treat that as suffix suicide? Right? Suffix suicide, right? So, you might be killing yourself, so you shouldn't do it, right? That's normally the way in which we function, right? If something is vada yasur, you shouldn't, right? If something else, if it's definitely going to happen, you shouldn't do it. If it's a suffix, it's going to happen. It's going to happen either. Yes, Mish?
Is it possible that there's, by definition, there's no such thing as suffix suicide? Because if essentially Hashem has control over your life, suicide would be taking your living or death into your own hands. But something where you're saying, like let's say, there's a possibility, all right, maybe I'll live, maybe I'll die, it's still Hashem's choice to control the reality. So there's no way, like if you put yourself in a suffix suicide situation, it's still not your causing it. You're setting up a situation where Hashem now still has two choices over whether to let you live or die.
Okay.
So the roulette is okay.
Right. That's exactly right. Exactly right. That's exactly right. That's the Nafkamina. The Nafkamina is Russian roulette. So I would like to
but not as suicide.
Right. I would like to believe with David that that Yerukhanan doesn't address the question of a suffix it entered into for no purpose at all. But it seems I would think the implication of what he's saying is that you can enter into a risk for a gain. But to risk your life for no gain, he would still think is usur. But I agree that he doesn't address it explicitly enough. But that's enough gemina, right? Was he think it's okay to play Russian roulette?
So no, it would be usur, but under a different category. It would be usur, not under suicide, but under risking your health.
So what's usur about risking your health, according to him?
Being healthy in general.
I don't know. He doesn't mention it. That's our whole issue, right? Why doesn't he just say? Then he could say that about risk also, right? But he allows risk for gain. Right? He doesn't say you're violating Mishnah Artemelo Nafshos Seichem. Why? Why should pain allow you, right? Then it should be a question of the chiyah. This pushes aside that.
Yeah.
All right? But he doesn't frame it that way. He frames it as you can't commit suicide, and after that it's discretionary. But his only examples are where you're doing it to avoid pain or things like that. So I would rather not leave it in the realm of suicide of just probability. I would rather try and actually make a reverse argument for Yaakov that he really thinks autonomy is valuable, and you should have the right to make decisions, but you don't have the right to make a decision that your life is valueless. That's the restriction. Right? You have to make decisions on the premise that life is valuable. Having made that decision, we can then talk about how valuable. That's how I'd like to set it up. Whether it's convincing or not, I'm not sure. I think at the very least what we can say is that Yaakov Emden is not really helpful for Dr. Steinberg's thesis. Right? He might not be as damaging as I want to write. I want to argue that it's actually a contrary principle. Right? Yaakov Emden's limitation of the prohibition of suicide to cases of vadai is actually an affirmation of autonomy, that the only place in which it's restricted is that. And I want to make clear that I don't think we paskin that way at all. I think Rav Yaakov Emden is really radically liberal on that. But at the very least, Rav Yaakov Emden doesn't serve as proof of any kind of broad principle of limitation of autonomy, because the whole thrust of him is to create space for autonomy. Yes?
I don't think Dr. Steinberg reads the Morafia incorrectly. He just presents the Matthias as if most of the cases were in that Vadai case. We are assuming that most of the cases are not. But it's his presentation of the Matthias that's wrong, not his presentation of the Morafia.
I don't think there's a halachic misrepresentation. He doesn't do it in any kind of depth. He just quotes the one case. I don't think it's a relationship to fact which way the cases are. I'm dealing with the theory of it.
Dr. Steinberg acknowledges that in cases based on that work theory, that in cases where it's not vadai, we would have faith in autonomy. He just pretends that those cases are very rare.
See, I don't think it's a question of rarity. I think it's a question of perspective. Do you say that really our goal is to compel you, but somehow the existence of a doubt prevents us from compelling you, because how do we impose, right, because it prevents us from imposing on you? And the other perspective is, no, that really our goal is to provide autonomy, but in some cases, that's just, right, we just can't do that, right? You can't go that far.
So both of those, I think, are equally legitimate readings of the Morafia.
So I think the second one is a better reading. It doesn't feel to me, and I think that there are places where he's saying, well, we would impose this on you, but there's a suffix, because there's an easy mechanism for avoiding that. The mechanism for that is rove. Right? We can turn any rove into a vadai.
Which rove?
We can say 51% is a vadai, right? And that radically increases the number of cases that become vadai. We also have a mechanism called suffix pikuach nefesh, right? Which we use also, right? So we can just say any suffix of pikuach nefesh.
Rove on what? On what I'm
going to
do?
Rove on what the outcome is. So we can impose, right? Any case which has a 51% chance of death, we can treat it as vada pikuach nefesh. We treat rove as vada everywhere else in the world. Why should pikuach nefesh?
Except when it's
kavua. Yeah, he doesn't pull out kavua here, and what the parameters of kavua and rove are also open to question. And as I say, pikuach nefesh dafka, in other areas, we just decide that suffix equals vada. Right, we're not constrained in every other area of pikuach nefesh. We're not constrained by the problem of suffix. We just say suffix equals vadai. So for him to claim, but here, right, it has to be absolutely vadai, right, bedukah gemurah, and any element of suffix reduces it. That to me is militates in favor of the second reading. Questions? Yes.
When he says "bduka u'mura vadai," he means that about the present, does not any spiritual.
Achuz.
Vivi,
vadai vivi.
Okay. Sorry. כשהוא אומר vadai, אז בהתחלה הוא משתמש במילים בדוקה. יש לו כמה פירושים לvadai. בהתחלה זה באמת לא בדוקה וגמורה, רק בשנייה זה בדוקה וגמורה, ואני חושבת שכשהוא אומר בדוקה, אז אני לא יודעת אם אולי הוא בכלל לא מתכוון למספר האחוזים, אלא לניסיון ממשי שיש בזה, אפילו יותר מזה, להבנה. זאת אומרת, האם, ולכן זה נראה לי החלוקה שהייתה אז, בשיעור הקודם, בין פנימי לחיצוני, שבפנימי, אתה לא יודע מה יש שם בפנים. וחיצוני זה לא רק של אחוזים. שאתה יודע כמה מניסיון, זאת אומרת שזה גם מובן, הוא גם נושא, איך קורא לזה גם עוד? לא רק בדוקה, אלא ידיעה ודאית והכרה ברורה בהם.
כן.
שזה הרבה יותר מובן, זאת אומרת, אם נניח, אתה שם יוד על פצע, אז אתה מבין את זה, זה ידיעה ברורה.
עם הבנה.
זה לא רק, כאילו כן, עם הבנה, זה לא רק הניסיון של הבדוקה. בדקתי כמה פעמים וזה באמת ככה.
אז אני מסכים לזה.
אוקיי.
אבל מה שאני אומר, שבדרך כלל בהלכה, לא צריכים זה עוד רע שצריכים, האם יש אחוז יותר מ-50?
האם צריך את ה...
50 ו-51, דרך כלל, 51 זה רוב, וזה עולה כאילו זה 100%. לא צריכים ידיעה ברורה, כל הביטויים האלה אומרים שהוא כאן מצריך יותר ממה שהוא מצריך בשאר פרטי הלכה, לעניין ודאי.
אני חושבת שמבחינתו, ידיעה של אחוזים היא לא משנה כלום, היא כמו הפנימית. זה בסדר, זה יכול להיות שזה הלך, יכול להיות שזה לא הלך. אם אתה מבין את זה, אם זה הכרה, אבל הכרה... ידיעה ודאית והכרה ברורה, אז זה בכלל לא עניין של אחוזים.
אבל אני לא חולק. אני רק אומר שבדרך כלל בהלכה האחוזים הם באמת נשנים. לומר שזה לא תלוי באחוזים כאן, אלא צריכים עניין של ודאות ממש, כן, זה חידוש.
שזה כאילו מעבר לסיטואן?
כן.
אוקיי.
זה הטענה שלי. And in general, you know, safek, in terms of pikuach nefesh, safek doesn't require, right, pikuach nefesh we say even 1%, right, afilo achuz echad, derech klal pikuach nefesh lechilul Shabbat, ze maspik, az madua ze lo maspik lekfiyah.
Ve'az amarta shezeh
bigal
shezeh harbeh spekot, shezeh...
Lo, ani choshesh bishvil shehu ohev ez autonomia.
Aha.
Az omer bishvil zeh, she'af shebikval safek, derech klal פיקוח נפש ספק אפילו אחוז אחד מספיק כשאנחנו משתמשים בפיקוח נפש בניגוד לאוטונומיה אז צריכים הכרה ברורה וידיעה וכדומה זה חידוש גדול
זה כאילו פשוט ערך שעומד מול זה
כן, זה מה שאני טוען שבאמת רדאק אנדין מעריך את האוטונומיה ולא מתנגד לזה Okay, we could talk at other points about, right, there's a whole broader shir I have about the whole nature of safek, and, right, which just pointing out, that I think it's valuable to point out tangentially that the category safek is a fungible category. We all know that 100% is vadai one way, and 0% is vadai the other way, and anything between 0 and 100 could be a safek. Right, that's one model. A second model is that we use rov. So everything between 50.0, everything between 0 and 49.9 infinitely repeating is vadai one way, and everything between 50. Pardon?
Not infinitely repeating, but that
Who says we accept limits?
I
don't know. Okay.
I'm walking out of this year if we don't.
I had a lot of problems with limits in high school, but if it makes you happy, right, 40.9 repeating infinity minus one times.
Oh, okay.
Right, whereas the I would say like the story I always say sports tell the story I would tell about this is at a general assembly many years ago Rabbi Yitz Greenberg got up and gave a shiur about how he had been given up sort of on certain types of aspects of chosenness because all human beings have infinite value and when he came to realize that all humans have infinite value he recognized that you couldn't make distinctions between Jews and non-Jews. And I raised my hand and I said, but it's not true that all infinites are have equal. Just say that's something against it, right? Many mathematicians hold us that infinity plus one is greater than infinity. So why can't we fit all even the infinite
well,
value?
Infinity plus one is not greater than infinity, but 2 to the infinity power.
Okay, right. Whatever the whole the hotel, Hilbert's hotel, right? All that, right? The whole gap. All the infinities are commensurate. And at that point, all the social workers in the room fell asleep. It was math, total math disinterest in the discussion. But I have my credential. All right, I've done this for real. all right. Okay.
When my grandfather on my father's side married my grandmother, but he was Taherid for a week and he finally got through because he recited Yivamot Baal Peh. When I married Deborah, I was Taherid on whether I could follow the notion of a fractal. By the fractal dimension. my father-in-law has yarmulke with a silver curve. And back then I could. Okay.
So that's what I wanted. So anyway, so the should recognize the category of safek is a fungible category. Again, it could be 50.01 to 100, 101 repeating. That one can repeat infinitely because it won't go down to 50, right? Right, so 50.01 repeating into you don't even need that though. 50.01 is larger, right? So 0 repeating with the one at the end.
There are no infinitesimals.
Right, right. 200 is wrote that way, and 49.9 with the qualifiers mentioned previously below is infinitely little. And the only case of safek is exactly even, and that model, the only cases of safek, obviously, are constructed tzvikot, right? Artificial 50-50 cases, which is what we call kavua. Right? No case is really 50-50, but there's a certain set of halachic parameters in which we say that we treat this as if it's 50-50 no matter what. But these create totally different religious sensibilities, because in one religious sensibility, all of life is how to navigate the probabilities. Right? How do you deal with safek? Right? If you think that everything less than 100 is safek, so then your life, you never have deal with certainties in life, you only deal with sfeikot. And the only thing that matters in life is safek deraisa l'chumra, safek derabanan l'kula. Right, that's how you make every decision in life. And on the other hand, in the other universe, you never need to know about it. Right, so I argued in a presentation I gave to the conference some years ago that this is the difference between the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch and the Mishneh Berurah, that if you read the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, the entire Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, you'll discover that the term derabanan only shows up in like 13 times in the whole book, and when it does, it's only to more than half the time is to tell you it doesn't make a difference whether it's derabanan or deraisa. I think 7 out of the 13 or something, right? It's to tell you they have deal with derabanan, right? Whereas in Mishneh Berurah it's all hundreds of times, and that's because the Aruch HaShulchan, this I learned from my grandfather, my mother's side, who never understood. I always get upset at these. My friends, the YU guys, would come in and give shiurim explaining that something was only Darabanan, who cares? I'd look at him and say, what do you care? It's only Darabanan Lakula. That's because I live in a world of fake code, but he didn't. He lived in a world in which if it wasn't 100, right, in which if it wasn't exactly 50-50, you decided based on rote. So why would something ever come up? Right, those are very, very different. I think a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch sensibility is a radically different sensibility than a Mishneh Berurah sensibility, and it's really worth thinking about. How one trains people to recognize uncertainty or to just make decisions. But I think Rav Yaakov Emden makes a very strong decision to limit the category of vaday dramatically, and I think that it's plausible, although I don't think it's compelling. Although you may decide it's compelling or decide that this is wrong. It's plausible that he does this because he sets value on the capacity to make your own decisions. Right, so he really limits the category of vaday. Okay, so now this was supposed to be when I said this, to test Steinberg's second thesis, which was that informed consent depends on a notion of the person owning the body, and we will avoid the philosophic morass of what constitutes the person that owns the body. Right, so I said there were two ways in which we had to test that thesis. One is the instances of rhetorical uses of the phrase "you don't own your body," and the other is the other is substantive laws, right, that might depend on the premise that you don't own your body. And so the Shulchan Aruch Harav was the first case where we really were largely dealing with rhetoric. Right, he says, "Ke'en l'adam reshut al gufo klal." But when we analyzed it, we discovered that "Ein l'adam reshut al gufo klal" was problematic for Dr. Steinberg's thesis in a number of ways. One is that it seemed to be framed in terms of pleasure and pain, as opposed to in terms of health. Now, we didn't really understand why pleasure and pain should be relevant to God anyway. Right? Why is, just because God owns your body, why does the body have to experience pleasure? Although, Weish argued that maybe, you know, there's some empathetic mode, right? I forget the exact formulation you had. In which God is a human being, so our pain is his pain. Imo anachi v'tzara, in a very, very literal sense. Right? Every pain, we feel God's pain. Okay. But it doesn't support the health thesis. Right, which is what he wants, which is what Dr. Steinberg wants it for, that you have an obligation to keep your body in good health. Maybe an obligation to live a hedonistic life, regardless of your health.
Why is that a support for
a
hedonistic life?
Because if God has pleasure when we have pleasure, and pain when we have pain, we should have lots of pleasure.
Pleasure, spiritual pleasure as well, and intellectual pleasure as well.
Sure.
It would be saying that a hedonistic life is not an evil, and yet at the same time, it is not the utmost.
Right, but why is health relevant? That's my question.
Why not?
Because why does it matter if you live a life, right? Why does it matter in this calculus?
You have less pleasure if you're unhealthy.
You have less pleasure if you're unhealthy. In this calculus, I had a choice of living a really happy 6 months or a painful 2 years. Right? The calculus may, on that level, the calculus is pleasure beats pain.
If you're looking at pleasure in a purely hedonistic sense rather than expand it out what pleasure is, you're right. Look, if you're looking at like a person has no other pleasures rather than physical pleasures, okay, fine, you're right. But 2 years of experiencing physical pain doesn't mean that those 2 years don't also experience, you know, immense spiritual pleasure which outweighs the physical pain.
That's fine, but he doesn't mention that when he talks about this. He doesn't mention that. Right? The Shulchan Aruch Harav doesn't mention you can experience pain for the sake of other kind of it, just as your responsibility is to not have your body experience pain. He doesn't talk about your experience.
Yeah, what if you're in so much pain that you won't be able to learn?
Yeah, that's a real thing. I don't know. Right, so then he says, and the second thing he says is that in fact you are allowed to experience pain so long as you have a spiritual purpose. Right, now the question is, well, what constitutes a valuable purpose? So now, you know, so that it doesn't really limit autonomy that way either. It just, right, all it does is it sets the framework and value of values in which you ought to exercise autonomy. Right, and lastly, it doesn't say anything whatsoever about whether we coerce you. Right, you're not allowed to. It's not the same as saying that we, right, if you were to take this argument to its logical extreme, we would say, well, here I am, I walk into lunch, and I say, you know what, I don't feel like eating ice cream today. Why don't you feel like eating ice cream today? Because it's just not important to me. I just not important to me. I would today. I feel anhedonic. I don't really feel the desire to experience pleasure. Well, tough. You guys pick me up, drag me over, and dump the ice cream down my throat. Because I am failing. If we believe in kriya. Right? Shouldn't we believe in kriya for that too?
No longer pleasure.
Oh, because I wouldn't really enjoy it.
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Because I wouldn't really enjoy it. But if I would really enjoy it.
The body's pleasures are clearly, they're very closely tied to a person's spiritual pleasures as well. This doesn't mean that just wouldn't be pleasure, and it's not even a sense of pleasure.
What if you're trying to lose weight? You are perfectly healthy in your body, but you want to be thinner and less. There's no way to force you to do that. You can create a scenario where you can be getting pleasure to you.
Yeah, it would be three less of onus to go from around
that.
Can
I ask a question?
But obviously it needs to be taken into consideration with other types of pleasure as well. But, you know, it doesn't contradict the fact that God, in addition to caring about the higher forms of pleasure, also cares about the
No, I'm fine with that. I'm just saying that the notion of coercion, right, that's it, right? Even if you accept that, right, that the principle that the Shulchan Aruch Rav is setting out is that you have no rights, doesn't mean that somebody else can force you to.
Okay.
Right? And the extreme, like, since you think you have no right to deny yourself ice cream in some circumstances, does that mean that we would think, that we would suggest that we would force you to experience, right? You know, let's say you're just scared, right? You're right. We think that it's a tremendous pleasure to ride roller coasters. And if we can only get you on the roller coaster, you'll have a great time. And I'm sufficiently confident of that to act on it. And you're just scared. Well, the heck with you. Right? Tie you up, put you on the roller coaster, right? That's a better example. There's no health risk, nothing like that. It's just that you're a coward. Right, so I will force you to experience this pleasure. Right? You're not going to eat this food because you're afraid to try new things. But I can tell you, I know you well enough. I know that you're really going to love this. So let's force it down your throat. I don't think you would say that. Pardon? No, no. But I think it happens more often with roller coasters than it does with food. I think it happens not infrequently in roller coasters. You know, at an emotional level. And he was jumping out of trees on zip lines. All right.
When he talks about Machal Mishneh, the fact that by Divrei Agadah, he's speaking about Kol Hana'a, Shadam Lo Ne'ena Mimena, Uchav Lamita, and things like that. And it doesn't mean exactly Machal Mishneh, like it doesn't so clear and defined as a thought. It thinks very widely, very broad.
נראה, לא רק אגדה זו, גם הלכה, נראה.
כן, אבל אני חושב ש... It doesn't mean exactly this, like שולחן ערוך says in צדיק ח' about תפילה, when you, before you pray, you should be התפשטות הגשמיות and all of this. He was stating, like, כותרת, our title, and he doesn't exactly every time don't eat. זאת אומרת, הוא לא מתכוון בדיוק שתקבע את זה עד סוף הגבולות, זה ככה אני חושב.
נראה, אני חושב שבישיר מן הגמרא על נזיר.
כן, זה גם...
ואז נראה שהם לוקחים את זה כעניין הלכתי ולא עניין אגדי.
כן, אבל זה דברי אגדה במקור, אבל אני חושב שזה לא מדויק, זאת אומרת, כמו כל הלכה, when you put your shoes, it should be, it's like the right first and then the left, זה יותר משהו כללי.
אהה. We'll see at the end how much you think, right, how useful that is halachically. Okay. So now we go to the Rambam in Hilchot Ratzeach Shmirat HaNefesh. Right, so here the Rambam tells you the halacha of kofir. The muzarin beit din shelo likach kofir min harasech, v'afilu natan kol mamon she ba'olam, v'afilu rata goel adam lefatro, she'ein nafsho shel zeh ha'nehra kinyan goel adam, ela kinyan ha'kadosh baruch hu. So what is this? Does this support Dr. Steinberg's thesis or not?
Does not.
Okay, explain to me why not.
I own my body, and I'm saying that God said you have to kill somebody, and therefore you have to do it. It doesn't matter that you don't want it.
Okay, so right. So the first thing you're doing, right? So let's be careful about the motive analysis. In the right, it deals with specific halakha. Right, so you can always claim that the rhetoric is meaning, right, the rhetoric only comes to back up halakha and can't teach you any broader claims. That's I'm going to grant that up front. Any evidence from rhetoric, you can always claim the rhetoric only supports this specific position. All right, so I want to try and work this, but let's assume that the rhetoric can be taken to stand for broader principles. Okay, let's assume that. Right, you're right, absolutely. That's right, rhetoric is enough. But let's assume that. Even if I grant him the proposition that this rhetoric is supposed to be generalizable, does this rhetoric say what he wants it to?
No, because it's not saying the body doesn't belong to the Osech, it's saying the body doesn't belong to the Goel Adam.
Right, which
means that the body can still belong to the Osech. That's to the Osech.
To the
Osech and himself. Whose body are we talking about?
Well, okay, so you can't. Well, the halacha that he's saying is the Beit Din cannot allow the Goel Hadam to accept
compensation, right, as a put, right, rather than carrying out the execution, which the Goel Adam is fundamentally required to carry out, but the Beit Din will carry out if the Goel Adam refuses to. Right, it says the reason for that is that the body of the killed is not the property of the, but rather the property of the of God. So now I'm asking you, that rhetoric, does that rhetoric support the claim Dr. Steinberg is making, and if not, why not?
I don't think it does, because it's talking about the body of someone. The body, it's not about the body belonging to the person itself, it's talking about the body belonging to someone else at some level. And
good, okay, let's find it sharply. So what does it exclude? Whose ownership does it exclude?
Someone else.
As opposed to?
His own.
Good, okay, right, that's the first stage, right? All this says is, that right, all this says is that the Goel Adam doesn't own it as much as God does. Okay, that doesn't tell you, right? You might say, okay, but he owns it himself. Well, so what? He's not there to own it anymore. Right? It doesn't tell you who owns it, right? There might have been a partnership, a 90-10 partnership in which I own my body 90%, God owns it 10%, but now I'm dead. So my ownership rights revert to God. So now God owns 100% and the Goel Adam owns nothing. Right? That's on the all the rhetoric does is exclude the ownership of the Goel Adam. It says nothing about the ownership of the person himself. Yes, Rory.
Couldn't you also understand it then as if the person owned his own body, then by inheritance laws, the Goel Adam would have gotten the ownership? And that's by the fact that the Goel Adam doesn't get ownership, he didn't own his body?
Okay, you could defend it that way by saying that, right, that ownership of the body should be hereditary. Right? I'm open to that possibility. But I also am open to it not being true, right? If Dr. Steinberg's premise depends on hereditability of bodies, right? It's not right. That's not the world. It's not the world strong. But this matters, by the way, nowadays in terms of whether we believe that relatives should have a formal role to play in terms of post-mortem organ donations, right? Right. As opposed, you might think, well, obviously, relatives have a role to play because they know what the person thought best. No, of course not, right? Because right, the obvious answer to that is no. We know what the person wanted. The person wanted to do what halacha tells them to do. And that, of course, rabbis know best. So why should relatives play any role at all, right? Obviously, right, should just be an objective decision by a rabbi. Right, so the notion that relatives have rights over the disposal of the body is actually very relevant, and there's actually a strong evidence for that. Strong evidence for that is that the chiyuv kvura is on the relatives. So while I'm being making fun of it in one sense, it's not really fair. Right? I think you're right that that's a premise of the position. I just don't think it's an absolute enough premise to make this evidence the other way. Okay. What else? What else serves to limit this? See, now all of you, I translate it tendentiously. Right, which will be right. What do you want to say, David?
Someone pointed out yesterday that not show and not compose.
Very good. Yeah. So what is right? So what is it that God owns?
Your life.
God owns.
Not your body, not what you can do to your body, but it seems like your life. It's also because this is what someone says later on. But it's almost like emden. You can't take your Your life doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the other person. But not anything with body and risk and health.
Good. So let's frame it this way. What is the wrong for which the murderer is punished?
Taking someone's life.
Okay, taking someone's life makes it interpersonal. All right, so let's frame it right. Removing the nefesh from the goof. All right, so if we frame that, right, is that a wrong to the goof? Or is that a wrong to the nefesh? If we frame it as a wrong to the goof, right... Pardon? Or it could be wrong to both, right? We have those three possibilities, right? Right. Goof, nefesh, or both together. If we frame it as a wrong to the goof, then the response has to be, no, God owns the body. But if we frame it as a wrong to the nefesh, right? What you did wrong, the wrong is that you removed God's nefesh from the place where God wanted it to be. That tells you nothing whatsoever about the body. Right, the Goel Adam may own the body for all we know. He's not taking the money for the body. Right, he's taking the money for the removal of the nefesh. Right, so that the Goel Adam has nothing to do with. Even if he owns the body absolutely. Right, even if we hold that the Goel Adam can happily sell the body, right, to exhibit it in some museum or something like that. It matters not to us at all. That's what I want to. So I want to argue that you have to continually distinguish between death and other, and other issues on this. And here the language is, the language is helpful. Right, she'ain nafsho shel zehenera kinyan go adam l'tzina kadosh baruch hu. Right, doesn't say she'ain gufo. Yes. Nefesh Ratzeach, as Shura Pasuk, lo tikach kofer liftor et Nefesh Ratzeach in mita. Aval Haram omer shebechol zot, im lochim et ha-kofer, lochim et ha-kofer tmurat Nefesh ha-nirtzach.
Yes. So why say Shenemar? It's like, suppose
that Pasuk will chazek oto. I chosher shekol ma shechashuv ba-pasuk zeh lo tikhu kofer l'Ratzeach. Anyan Nefesh lo kashur. I understand the claim, but so how do you fit the line lo tichu kofel nefesh rotzeach with Haramam omer beferush she'ein nafsho shel zehan herag as ma hakbala ben shel zehan herag le nefesh rotzeach?
That's why I don't understand
here
in the Rambam.
Aha, okay. So Niemir, so Lulaya raya lo milad nefesh papasuk ela lulo hayahab המילה נפש מופיע בפסוק, היה אברהם מביא אותו הראיה. הפסוק אומר, לא תיקחו כופר לרוצח.
Okay, so the nefesh is just
a... Yeah, זה מה שאני חושב. אני מכיר שזה בעיותי, ויהיה יותר טוב אם יהיה אפשר ליצור איזה הקשר בין המילה נפש בפסוק למילה נפש במשפט הקודם ברמבו. Yes,
yeah, the truth is, the first time I read it, I assumed that here, for some reason, the word neherag meant nirtzach, just because I thought it made more sense that way. If we read neherag to mean...
You mean the to be killed as opposed to the has been killed.
Right, because if we read neherag to mean the person who has been killed, I'm just sort of confused as to what it would mean. Why does... Oh, it means that ownership of the soul of
is God.
Who is already killed is...
God.
Is God, but...
Therefore, the Gol Adam can't accept compensation.
Because the premise is, if you own the soul, you get the discretion as to whether or not you can accept compensation.
Because the wrong was done to you.
Well, why is the wrong done to you if you own the soul?
Because the wrong that was done was the removal of the soul from the body.
So you're saying it's a wrong done to the soul, and because your ownership of the soul, now the wrong was done to you?
Yeah.
Thing to say.
Why? The wrong was done to your ox. Your ox, right? So you get this.
The wrong was done to somebody else's ox, and then you inherit the ox.
Yeah, then you inherit the claim.
It just seems to make a lot more sense to me if we're now talking about the future.
Uh-huh.
Especially if you read Nefesh, then it's not talking about souls, and then you find yourself in some sort of metaphysical debate as to whether or not you're wronging the soul or the body by removing the soul from the body. It just means life. Right, your life is forfeit. Yeah.
I can't prove it. My feeling is that it should say haneherag when he hasn't yet been killed. That's the whole issue, right? It is hard.
I hear you totally, and I understand that the word neherag is also used before to talk about the actual neherag.
Yeah.
But I just can't shake the feeling that the word should be near. The word should be rotzeach.
It should be near tach, according, right? You're saying that you want to read it as the rotzeach because it doesn't say near tach.
Right, exactly. Even the Nirtzach was referred to as the Neherag earlier.
Okay, I understand the point. It goes together with Adi's point. I'm not convinced, but I don't have a disproof. It just feels it just doesn't feel right to me. So that's I can't. That has to be your judgment call. Yes, Rav.
Yeah, I'm just I was just wondering, I buy the point that we were making a clear distinction between kinyan and Hashem having kinyan and nefesh versus kinyan and the goof. What I wonder is, if there was such a concept of people have Hashem having a kinyan on the goof, then would that appear, say, in the Isurim of tattooing or parachat and these sorts of things? Do we have examples of that?
That's interesting. I only have the rhetoric that is cited by the people in the article on this subject.
Right.
Nobody, to my knowledge, has brought up. All the cases that are cited are in the packet.
Okay.
And I think that's the.
Is it worth maybe going through the.
Worth looking and seeing if anybody came up with it. But yeah, so far as I know, from what I know, that's not the. You know, there is a whole notion of, by tattooing, people talk about the notion of, you know, God. You know, God gave you a body, you shouldn't mess it up, but
right.
It's
a colloquial term, but I'm wondering...
Right, it's a problem that runs into Rabbi Akiva and the wheat, you know, and us eating bread, right, and Mila. Right, the fact that we do Mila, right, which we then defend by saying that God gave us perfectible bodies, so anybody, you know, so as long as you see his tattoos as aesthetic as opposed to as destructive, then the whole argument falls apart.
Right.
But it's not, right, so I don't think it's a very good treatment of, a very good explanation of tattooing. You can try and assimilate the prohibition of being the karchot karcha, all right, or lo tisgodedu, on that, you know, but then you just assimilate them to chavala ba'atzmecha, and actually we'll see that some of the evidence that chavala ba'atzmecha is mutar is if it were us, or who would need a prohibition, right, of being the karech elamet, right? So it goes both ways. Yes, there is. Do I think there is an Isser of cremation as opposed to a Bitul Chiyav Kvura?
As opposed to, Chiyav Kvura, it can either be Kavod Hameis or it's Bizayon Hameis not to.
Right.
Right, so if it's Kavod Hameis, the Hameis can be Mofel. And
maybe.
If you're in a society...
Not so clear, not every kind of Kavod can be Nimchal, we'll talk about that in a moment.
And if it's... So during a society where cremation is a honorable way of treating a dead body, it's not a desire. There should be no if the dead person says this is what he wants, there should be no real issue of cremation, unless you're willing to hold that it's not his body.
Or unless you hold it as a chiyuv kvura, which isn't based on kavod, which is based on some metaphysical notion that either kiyafara talvi lafar tashuv, or it might be the halakha decided to be koveya absolutely. A principle, even though in some societies cremation. I understand you can construct a theoretical philosophic defense of cremation. I don't know that necessarily has to translate.
I think that's
an opinion of the shadow. Why don't we just use autopsies, which we will. We're going to get to autopsies in 2 weeks. I think it's better than cremation. Right? Can you allow autopsies and organ donations? Cremation.
But that sometimes goes on vision because sometimes you override a lot of it.
Let's say it's not pikuach nefesh. Let's say it's not. If it's pikuach nefesh, you shouldn't need permission. Right. So I think if after that you still think cremation is a better test case, then right, then we can talk about that.
I think why is it
chayeh,
no? Pardon?
I think if there are all sorts of, there's also kilalat lekim talui, right? There's gefar tavi lafar tashuv. Right, there's a whole bunch of issues. If we wanted to do kvura per se, we'd do it. I'd rather deal with it in the autopsy context. And if it turns out that cremation needs to be discussed, then that's not right. That's fine too. Okay. So then I gave them order to him just. Oh, oh yes, sorry.
I was wondering regarding the Rosh in general.
Yeah.
He has a responsibility to go after. The person who killed his brother or whatever.
Yeah, the Galadon, yeah.
What gives him that responsibility? Usually when we talk about having responsibility for something, it's also a partnership with ownership, like in a marriage or something like that. So it's what gives him responsibility?
Some notion of ownership. Relatives have some notion of ownership. I think you can construct the theory that all relatives own, you know, the notion of geula by property seems to imply that, you know, that families own property together. At least, you know, at least land is owned together that way. We always talk about Yibum, right? I think, you know, I talk about it in terms of ownership. You can talk about it the way Professor Levinson does, that
there's a notion of corporate identity. Right? And it's, right, it's not that I own you, it's that in some sense all members of the family really are part of one another. I think that's certainly possible to construct. I don't know that it's true, but it's possible. Right, because you might, what's the halamina that the nefesh of the Nehrag is the kinyan, if the kinyan goel adam? Right, so the halamina seems to imply something of the sort. Absolutely. Okay, then I gave you the Mordechim, and the whole point of the Mordechim was to point out the Rambam doesn't say this in the Mordechim. Right, the Mordechim, he says it's because ein adam esim atzmo, in the Mordechim he says it's because this is a really bad sin. And he leaves out this whole rhetoric. So how seriously to take this rhetoric, right, when in other places the realm is perfectly conventional, leaving it out, I leave it to you.
I thought
you thought that?
I thought the first rhetoric is for you. Usually the realm uses that as
yourself.
This is a really bad thing to do.
Yeah. Maybe this is just a window dressing thing, you know? Murder is really, really bad. Why? Because you're killing something of God's. And that's all it means. Right? And everyone agrees that there's some notion in which the Adam is Kinyan HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? Here's an easy example where, right, who can give you the pasuk which proves that Kinyan HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't mean that somebody else doesn't have Kinyanim. Batomer, Kaniti Yishet Hashem. Right? So there's a classic example, right? God has a Kinyan, but I have a Kinyan too. Right, it doesn't exclude a partnership. Who is the controlling partner? Lo yada. Now we could argue that was a chait, right? And really, it was not. It shouldn't have been kneti yitzir Hashem. We get the whole discussion, right, over what the meaning of chavas naming of kain is. But prima facie, I don't think that rhetoric has to mean anything. Okay, then we get to the Rambam. We're not trying to prove the halachic perspective. We're trying to prove the philosophic perspective. Right, there's no nafkamina halacha. You can't take kofar. Right. Yes.
I mean, I guess there's also room to say though that because what immediately persists underlined, right? You think about grouping as like ufo, music of one, music of another, yesh lava hamon v'chola ulakel. Or you could say that in the case that seems to promote a conception where basically everything besides the actual life of a murderer is like a tradable commodity and something that is.
So we could push it out of the other. It's true that really it's only the nefesh and the goof is fine.
Right.
Because we take kofir for Kabbalah. Why do we take kofir for Kabbalah? Right. So it might be, but that proves that if we argue that the inability to take kofir demonstrates that the nefesh is not, then the ability to take kofir for Kabbalah proves that the goof is.
The Rambam says that from Qudos from Ephra, it should only be ayin ha-ha-fine.
Right, but we allow you to take kofir. Obviously, it's your right.
He doesn't know what to do with that. He's just like, yeah, that's how the Gemara learns it.
If I wished to write an article in which the assignment was, make it right, come up with a philosophic argument on the question of whether God, right, of whether human beings have any ownership rights in their body from the following text, I might find it easier to write the argument from these texts showing that human beings do them if they don't. But I wouldn't. I'm not prepared to say informed consent is critical because you own your body. Because look, the Rambam allows right. The Rambam says that the reason you don't take kofir for murder is that you don't own your body. Mashma that the fact that you do take kofir chavala means you do own your body. That seems a long way to go from the evidence we have. But I think it's at least as plausible as the reverse. I think that it just tells you that you can't prove anything from this. It's rhetoric. Okay, now we get to the Rambam Hilchos Sanhedrin. So the Rambam Hilchos Sanhedrin. So let's see. Were you up to this?
I'd like to get this back.
Yeah. Good. So, in your understanding, according to the Rambam, why don't you execute people who confess?
I think there were two different reasons. One
good.
Was that you don't, the person can't bear witness against himself because he's the closest person to himself.
Does the Rambam mention that here?
Is it in this one or not in this one?
Don't think so, right? No, I don't. It doesn't mention that here.
And then the other one was that.
Well, so take a look at the text, right? In the text, right? What does the Rambam say? Sanhedrin neither executes nor whips confess, right, people who confess. Why? Right, what does he say in the next three lines?
Oh, because they might have a death wish.
That's, I think, Pashat Pshat in the Rambam. You don't do this because they might have a death wish. Right? Meaning that what's right? Meaning what? That they might actually be lying. Okay, so they might be lying, and what's wrong with that? So right, so they lied because they wanted to, because they wanted you to kill them, and you killed them. So what went wrong? So that implies, that assumes that you that this is wrong. Right, it's wrong to kill people even if they want to be killed.
But it's not wrong. It's too.
At the very least, it's a perversion of justice, right? make an argument to say that if somebody wants to be killed, they can be killed, but they shouldn't take advantage of the judicial system to do it because that sort of makes a mockery of the system.
It's a problem for judicial economy. There could be real quotations in China.
Now, you should be aware, by the way, that this is a...
Another bad expression. Right.
Up front, we should say that this is... You should be aware this is a real phenomenon. Right? That any time there is a public murder, there is a raft of false confessions. Right? And the police are fully aware of this. There's a raft of... Right? Whether it's because they want to be executed, right? You know, I don't know if there are any studies showing whether that the number of confessions diminishes when you take away the death penalty or not. But this is a real phenomenon. People do confess falsely, especially to capital, right? To serious crimes. The Radbaz builds on this, right? And the Radbaz makes the claim that this is built on the same notion as what we saw in terms of the Kofar, that the human being is God, and therefore you have no right to confess so as to cause your own death. Now that's a very peculiar notion. What's the easiest proof that this is? I mean, I would say the proof that this is an absurd argument. Well, okay. Let's grant that this is plausible in the Rambam. Okay, let's grant that for now. Right? You're right. Let's grant that this is plausible in the Rambam. Then we could read this way around. We ought to say, no, this is an absurd argument, right? What's the easiest proof this is an absurd argument?
The word box?
Yeah.
But Malkoth.
Okay, we can tell the Malkoth. That I think is a weakness. But it's just a way. But just make it. It's just prima facie. It doesn't get started. Yes, John.
I mean, in the classic case of egos is you clearly don't own the person that you're testifying.
Absolutely right. You don't own other people either. Right, you can testify to get other people executed. Why? Because they're supposed to get executed. They did something wrong. So why are you different than anybody else? Right? This is just absurd. Right, if you look at it that way, yes, dude.
The Torah told you you're supposed to listen to him.
Good. So the Torah told you you're supposed to confess. Right?
So God said, this is how you're supposed to deal with my property. Kill it if Adam testified about this.
Right.
That doesn't mean you.
What about what gives me the right to be an aid?
The Torah.
Good. So I'm being an aide.
You're one
aide.
You don't kill people on one
aide. No, that's about being command and them. Right, that's the whole issue, right?
Right, but we have a chashash mishaker here.
No, I didn't ask. But the Radbaz says that the reason we don't accept your confession is that you're not allowed to confess because since God owns your body, you can't be the cause of your body's
death.
That's
not how I understood the Radbaz.
Let's go back and look at it then. Right? So Radbaz says, the Shalat text Tatam, Lefisha ain nafsho shel adam kineneoli kinyan kodesh baruchu, right? Shneamar nafashot lihena, hilchach lo toil hodaato b'davar sheino shelo.
Lo toil.
He'll, because it's not his, therefore it won't help.
It won't help. The fact that you want to give up your life is not sufficient cause for the Beit Din to kill you. Because the Beit Din
because the basin needs believable aidas to kill you, and we have a chashash for shocker that maybe you're lying.
No.
No.
No, the Tehechid ain't a dumb Rashai Laharoga
that smo. I think David has a point in thinking he went too far. That we, it's not saying that we're saying you, if you want to end your life and therefore admitting to it, that doesn't help us.
Right.
But Adim don't want to. Adim just saw the thing. It's not that, you know, you can't use the court to end your life, basically what he's saying. Because it's not really your life.
Is David saying that? I thought David, right, do you understand? Let's read the whole thing together again, okay? Okay, but the money is yours. And we shum hachi, and because the money is yours, therefore we say hoda'at baldin kemei edim dame, therefore we treat your testimony as the equivalent of 100 witnesses, and you're saying not in terms of credibility, but in terms of legal effect. Right? Okay, right. V'chihechi de'en adam rashai laharog ad atzmo, and just like a person is not permitted to kill himself, now where, how do you explain that? Shouldn't it be...
You have, I mean, so, think like the Ketosan Kodat Baldi Kamei Adami. You are believed for anything which impacts only yourself.
Right.
So when you testify about your money, that affects only you.
Good.
Your beliefs. When you testify about your body isn't yours. It affects God, who is not you. So you're not believed.
So if the Rabbah said the following, "V'chihechi din adam rashai l'harog et atzmo." Kain ein ma'aminim adam ha'model atzmo. That would be fine. He doesn't frame it as the courts can't believe you. He frames it as you're not allowed to testify.
Okay. Right.
Yes. Okay. You did it, then Ron.
So I think the issue is here that there's a big difference between hoda'ah and etud. The issue is not right. He's not making you can't make the comparison saying you can't be me'id on somebody else because you don't own them. You can't be mode on somebody else because you don't own them. That's true. Because hoda'at baldin kamei edim damu, but not edut baldin kamei. So basically you're saying, right, here, in another case you would be saying, well, you're being mode that you owe $100 or $1,000. You're
right.
Saying you're being mode that you owe your life.
Right.
Right? So because you can be mode that you owe $100 or $1,000 because that's yours. You can't be mode on your life because you don't own your life. He's just
right.
Viewing it as the extension of the...
That's right. But why? Why can't I be moda? What is wrong with being moda? It's the consequence. I can't do the thing that... Right, I can't be moda because if I'm moda, that would cause.
No, you think you just can't be moda that you owe something that's not yours. You can't be, right, you can't agree voluntarily to give up something that's not yours.
I can't be moda that I owe... $100 of Daniel.